Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This week's episode of Book Cheat is brought to you by Audible. Visit audible.com/bookcheat or text BOOKCHEAT to 500-500. Hello and welcome to Book Cheat, the book club podcast where I've read the book so you don't have to. My name is Dave Warnicki, and on each episode of this show we look at one of the classics. And joining me to look at such a classic this week, it's Michael Hing and Matt Stewart. Hello.
Hello, Dave.
Hey, Dave. Hey, Hing. How's it going?
Hey, Matt. I recently did an episode of your other podcast, Do Go On, and Matt, you didn't turn up to that. But now I'm here with Dave and Matt, and there's no Jess Perkins. And I'm slowly going to do all of your podcasts without one of you and work out what the perfect who the perfect one of you to replace me, for me to replace would be. So right. Just know you're both being assessed by me today. Actually, no, sorry. Just know that Jess Perkins is being assessed today in her absence.
Well, yeah, it'd almost be a compliment, though, wouldn't it? It'd be whoever you want to replace as the person you fit that you sort of line up best with.
Yeah, or it's potentially just like they're the dead weight, and I feel like I could most easily slot in.
Who Hing sees as the weakest link?
Yeah,
that he could take down.
I could save you some time if you want, Hing.
I'm something of a hyena, and think of yourselves as a pack of gazelle, and one of you is limping.
I think I've been limping my whole life.
You're definitely the run of the litter, Dave.
Don't make me run. Please. Yeah, I'm the run of the litter. I'm the run in most litters, let's be honest. But you know, also as runts do, they start a book podcast. So great to have you.
Yeah, the clue is in being invited on Dave's book podcast.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. It is a book podcast. I usually ask before we get into the book that I've been reading if you guys have been reading, or Matt, in your instance, I know you love to listen to audiobooks. If you've been reading or listening to anything.
As a modern man, I read with my ears.
Beautiful.
And I do with my eyes closed. And I've been listening / reading iPartridge over the last couple of weeks.
What's that?
It's an Alan Partridge autobiography in character. Read by Steve
sounds awesome.
Coogan in character. It's so good. I've been listening to it as I go to bed, about an hour a night, loving it. It's real good.
Does the laughs wake you up? Like you know, if something's really funny, you're like trying to drift off and then you're like, don't laugh. Here it comes.
Yeah, sometimes early on it does get a bit like that, but you know, I think it's a lot easier. I used to listen to podcasts going to sleep, but too many voices, there's too much energy. One person doing a monologue is a lot easier to drift off to, even when it is pretty amusing stuff.
Yeah, okay.
I'm fascinated by people who listen to things as they go to sleep. What is your setup?
My setup is I've got this. It's like a sleep headband with inbuilt headphones. So
damn, I've seen those advertised to me, and I've always thought that's going to kill me. But it seems to be working for Matt Stewart.
Yeah, I had one that was Bluetooth, and it was. I started feeling a bit paranoid about having a Bluetooth thing on my brain.
So brain tumors and whatnot, obviously.
Yeah, for a third of the day or more. So I went and got an old school plug-in, you know, auxiliary cable one, and that's what I use now.
But do you wake up tangled?
Not too bad. But I've got I've got that and an old iPhone, which had an auxiliary plug in it, and I just use that. That way, I don't have my phone in bed with me, which I don't wake up and go straight on to social media and stuff.
So for you to do this, you've purchased an analog sleep headband, and also you've got an old secondary phone just for sleep sounds.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Wow. Yeah, right.
Set up. Yeah, taking it seriously. Works well. Wow.
I'm taking it seriously. Yeah.
So I know this is not what the podcast is about, Dave, but
hey, it's all sleep chat. It's all book related.
Because I'm sure a lot of listeners would listen to this as they go to sleep, or other podcasts as they go to sleep. I've been listening to football podcasts as I go to sleep recently. Actually, I say recently, for the past 3 or 4 years now. And before that, I used to listen to comedy podcasts, but like you, Dave, too much energy, too many zingers. I mean, like you, Matt, sorry, too much energy, too many zingers, too many voices. So football podcasts I've started listening to. I've been tangled up in my little earbuds a couple of times. And so I sleep in bed with someone, and I don't mean to brag. My girlfriend Hum, she doesn't know anything about football and has no interest in football. But she said, "Oh, can you just play the podcast out loud so I can listen to them as I go to sleep?" I was like, "Sure." But now what happens is I put them on for 5 minutes, and then I end up just explaining football to her for 45 minutes and neither of us goes to sleep, and it's the worst possible solution.
And you've been doing this for 3 years.
No, this latest development has been about 12 weeks. It's been sort of Sydney lockdown. So maybe 12 or 13 weeks, 3 months maybe. And I can't think of a way to solve it.
When you say football, that's like EPL.
Oh, like soccer football, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, like European soccer.
I've started trying to get more into NFL this year, American football, and so I downloaded a few podcasts, and the only time I really listen to podcasts is going to bed. Yeah. So I tried like three different ones, and their energy level is off the scale.
The natural charisma of Americans means you just can't go to sleep.
They're yelling. They're so excited, like right off the bat. One of them literally had air horns within the first couple of minutes. And I'm like lying in bed going, I don't think this one's going to work. And I mean, because the logic was, I think listening to something you don't know that much about, a lot of it sounds a bit like gibberish.
Oh,
so
sure.
You can sort of, you learn a little bit, but you drift off as well because you can't quite focus.
That makes sense.
Like a lot of people who listen to this podcast, I think. And then, I don't know, was that a good zinger there, Dave? Cop that.
Ow.
You look more confused than hurt by it. The air horns made that too difficult.
Well, I've just noticed we're about to be 7 minutes into the podcast, and 7 minutes is how long it takes for someone on average to fall asleep. So if you're listening to this and you're trying to go to sleep, have a wonderful dream.
Well, I'm just going to put in the air horns right here to pep this thing back up. Beep, 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 beep. And we're back.
You work on the radio, Hing.
Yes.
So you would have to do, you'd have to do a bit of reading probably to talk to guests who are on book tours and stuff sometimes.
Mm, yeah, a little bit of that. Currently though, to be honest, we've probably interviewed about 12 people who have books in the year and a bit I've been doing the show, maybe year and a half I've been doing the show, and I reckon I've read maybe 4 of the books, and they were people who are my friends. Right. It's not like we're not doing, like, it's Triple J. It's not like, you know, it's not like Radio National or something where you've got to do a hard-hitting 45-minute interview with someone. It's just like, and often sometimes with writers, I find if you ask them about the book, it's not actually interesting radio. You actually don't want them to just tell you about the book because they know everything about this one subject, and for them to condense it down into a 3-minute like radio break or whatever, it just sends them insane. They find it insulting. So it's much better just to get to know them as a fun person or get them to tell some fun stories and then just at the end be like, also, they've got a book and go buy this book. It's about, you know, the Aztecs or whatever.
Yes.
But I have been reading a book recently this last week. I don't know when everyone's listening to this, but we're recording this about a week from when or a couple of days after the comedian Norm Macdonald died. And I had his book on my bookshelf and had never actually read it. So I'm reading that, and it is, as everyone is saying, just so funny, and it's the best, and he's so, so funny.
I haven't read that. I saw a bunch of people put out, like, screenshots of pages of, and everything I read was so funny. I was like, I got to read this.
Yeah, it's. I highly recommend it. I'm about 100 pages into it now, and it's just the best.
Oh, that's so good. It's not on Australian Audible, unfortunately.
Oh, so you can't...
It seems to be, maybe it's on... There is an audio book of it, but it's not available here for whatever
Would
reason.
You like me to... how about as I read it now, Matt, I'll read it out loud and I'll send you an MP3 file. Of
Either
me
MP3
reading
or you can just call me whenever you're reading. Whatever I'm doing, I'll stop and I'll listen in.
Okay. What time do you go to bed? I'll call you.
Hey, I'm flexible. I'll go to bed whenever
I'll
you
read
call.
You to sleep.
That'd be lovely.
You just have to guess when he's asleep? I think he's asleep now.
I don't know.
I'm still here. All right. Sorry. Let me keep
You'll
going.
Know when I'm asleep. I've got a powerful snore.
Well, I've also been reading this week, and I have been reading Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, a children's classic for the ages.
Oh.
That is the story.
Is that why you got
this
on?
Is Alice in Wonderland?
Yes. That's why what we're talking about today.
Right. So, yeah, is this the original Alice in Wonderland?
Yes, the original one, published in 1835.
What was the author's name again? Peter Carroll?
Lewis Carroll. Carroll.
Huh. Peter Carroll's probably a footballer. Now, what's... But was there a whole series of these books?
There was...
There were quite a few Alice books. Oh. Two.
But then it's one of those things that's like, you know, permeated popular culture for over 150 years. So lots of adaptations, lots of media, lots of films and TV shows as well. Do you guys know much about it? Have you read the original one or seen movies or TV shows over the years?
I reckon this was read to me as a child and I have retained none of it. And I reckon I've seen the Disney film and maybe a few others. But the most memorable anchor I have to this book is the Disney film. It is Disney, right? Just the classic film.
Yes, there's a 1951 cartoon from Disney.
Yeah, that's the one I've seen a lot. What about you, Matt?
I've seen that one, and I've seen it. I reckon there was one I saw where one of the Cheers booze hounds plays Tweedledee or Tweedledum or both.
Oh, that's a vague like a live memory. Action one.
Yeah, maybe Norm actually. The guy plays Norm in Cheers. Norm.
Huh.
And there was another one. I reckon it was a telly movie from when I was a kid, sometime in the 90s. And that was the one I've seen the most. And it was, yeah. Do all of them have the mirror part? And it's kind of freaky. She can't get back at one point.
I think that's the sequel, Through the Looking Glass.
Right.
But I imagine that they sort of like... put them together and just get the best bits of you in a bunch of them.
I'm just having all these vague memories. And I definitely saw the one with Johnny Depp at the cinemas 10 years ago, whenever that came out as well.
Johnny Depp?
Cool. Yeah, I never saw that. Yeah, it was a Tim Burton movie and they also made the sequel as well. But yeah, I haven't seen that. Nice one. Well,
I remember that.
It's a very popular suggestion, it turns out. A bunch of people have asked me to do it. And if you want to suggest a book, there's a link in the description of this episode. And a bunch of these people did that. They filled out a form and said, hey, you should do Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And I'd like to just quickly shout out to them. That's thanks to Alison Day from Leahy, Utah. Quentin Chalair from Northport, Florida. Seba from Iceland. Johnny Dawson from Leicester. Raina Ramirez from Cerritos, California. Harry Green from Cowes on the Isle of Wight. James Mawson from somewhere in England. Miriam White from Canberra. And Hazel Jaggers, what a name, from Hailsham. Hazel Jaggers.
Hazel Jaggers, that is very good.
You have listeners in the Isle of Wight?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
I don't know a lot about the Isle of Wight. I thought the Isle of Wight was I thought it was one of those decommissioned World War II naval stations or something that became a micronation. Is that the Isle of Wight? Or is the Isle of Wight actually a place?
Yeah, it's like...
Hang on. Oh, no, I've Googled it. It is the largest and second most populous island of England. Okay, it's quite big. It's quite big.
Yeah. Well, there's the Isle of Man.
Maybe I'm thinking of one of those. Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay.
I think people live there as well.
Yeah, it has. No, but there's some micronation.
Are you thinking of Sealand?
Sealand, I'm thinking of Sealand, Dave. Yeah, sorry. I apologise to listeners in the Isle of Wight. I thought you were a decommissioned World War II station. Well, you're actually a real place.
I'm actually a Lord of Sealand.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Can you buy it on the internet? Or yeah, have you sort of done a hostile takeover? Have you done a coup in Sealand, Matt?
Well, that was the second option, but luckily they just let me buy one online. Let Dave.
That's right. I bought Jess and Matt titles for Sealand. We did a report about them on Do Go On.
Oh, right.
And then I won a competition where I won some money. Thank you very much to Jess and Matt for campaigning. And part of that was I promised them that I would buy them titles for
far out.
Three Lords and Ladies.
How
of
much
Sealand.
Did you get? What did you win? And how much did you spend on the titles?
Well, let's not go into exact figures. It's difficult to say because I had to buy it in pounds. It cost me several $100. No, maybe not even.
Oh my goodness!
I've looked up Peter Carroll, by the way. He's an Australian actor. Peter Carroll.
Good to know. Good to know.
So there were people yelling at their iPods.
Absolutely, especially in the Isle of Wight, they were yelling. They were furious.
They're like, first Sealand, and now this. Yeah. God, this podcast has gone to the dogs.
Can't get anything right. Well, let me tell you about.
Can I tell you, Jess Perkins is doing really well in this episode.
She's looking good.
I could have told you that. You're wasting your time, King. She's first pick, then Dave, and there's quite a bit of daylight, I think.
Hey, happy you mentioned in the top two. Thanks very much. Now, I usually give a background to the book, so why change now? So Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, it's an 1865, I said 35 before, I meant 65, children's novel by Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, better known by his pen name, Lewis Carroll. Dodgson arrived at his pen name by taking his own name, Charles Lutwidge, translating both words into Latin as Carolus Ludovicus, then reversing and then retranslating them into English. So he basically did that thing where you like used Google Translate and then translate it back, but in the 1850s.
That's clever.
So yeah, that's how he's Lewis Carroll, and that's what everyone knows him as. He grew up in a household of 11 children, and they used to entertain each other with games and made-up stories.
11's too many, I think. Oh, I mean, obviously, it's a different time back then, and you shouldn't judge people, but 11 seems like a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
A lot of children.
Yeah, I wonder if they know what was causing it.
Well.
Little joke there. Joke.
Do you reckon they had 11 kids there because they didn't realise that that sex is what caused children?
Yeah, imagine. They go, it happened again.
Why does this keep happening?
That's weird. We've got 11 kids and we've had sex 11 times.
Strange. Very strange.
Strange. It's very strange. Anyway.
So he was always telling stories to his brothers and sisters. He grew up to be a teacher of mathematics at Oxford and a deacon of the Anglican Church. But he told stories to the children of Henry George Liddell, a family friend, and one day he told them the story of Alice's Adventures Underground, named after one of the girls he was talking to, Alice. And the kids liked it so much that he wrote it down, and then the rest is history.
Alice's Adventures Underground does not sound like Alice in Wonderland. Alice's Adventures Underground sounds like her going to a rave where she takes ketamine, honestly.
Deep in the K-hole.
That does feel a bit like, I've never had ketamine, but it feels like the adventure she goes on could be the kind
could
of
be
thing.
Ketamine related. Yeah. Honestly, ketamine induced.
Honestly, it's starting to finally make sense to me. It was popular almost from the moment it was published and has remained in print ever since, influencing everyone from Walt Disney to Salvador Dali. Lewis Carroll became a famous name and he entertained children by reading stories to them. Eventually, he was invited to entertain two grandchildren of Queen Victoria herself. So he became very famous in his lifetime. He published a sequel, like I said, Through the Looking Glass in 1871. And I love this from the Encyclopedia Britannica, which says, his poem, The Hunting of the Snark, is nonsense literature of the highest order.
Oh, it is. That's, because he also wrote Jabberwocky, didn't he?
Yes, that comes from, I believe, Through the Looking Glass.
Right. Yeah. My great-grandmother, who was a Chinese-Australian person, a Chinese-Australian person, but grew up in Australia, so had like a very, very thick Australian accent. One of her party tricks was she knew all the words to Jabberwocky or whatever, and so would do it like for us kids and stuff. And so there was a time when I thought a lot of the words in Jabberwocky were real words because it was just a thing my great grandmother said. And so, like Guile and Gimble, I'm like, oh, that just means over there, you know? Like.
That must have been very confusing to find out.
Yeah.
You're in the playground. Jabble Jimble?
Yeah.
Jabble Jimble?
Yeah.
What is this kid saying? Jabble Jimble? Oh, my goodness.
Jimble Jom. Jimble Jom, guys? Are we all together? You've been a real Bandersnatch, frankly.
I've heard of that one.
Mm.
That's the... Isn't that something else?
Bandersnatch is... I think that is... It's a line in Jabberwocky.
It was used for the name of the interactive Black Mirror, I think, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. Right. Yeah, there you go.
It's hard not to mention that when he died in 1898, he was seen by Victorians as a fun guy that entertained children. But his reputation has come into question since then. And to quote from the Smithsonian, Lewis Carroll is treated like a man you wouldn't want your kids to meet, yet his stories are still presented as classics of pure, innocent literature.
Huh.
And I dug
Wait. What are we talking like? He'll give him like a cigarette, or he'll do something to them? Why wouldn't you want him to meet him?
Well, I went deep into the rabbit hole on this. Because I had heard the story before that he was a bit sus with kids. But I must say...
How does a kid's story survive that?
I know, but reading into it, let me just say, in the 1930s, the book was psychoanalyzed by a writer named A.M.E. Goldschmidt, who wrote an essay titled Alice in Wonderland Psychoanalyzed, in which he suggested that Dodgson, Lewis Carroll, was suppressing a sexual desire for Alice, the main character. This was the beginning of speculation about the author, and since then multiple biographies have written, some suggesting that he had pedophilic tendencies that he never acted on, and some saying that he absolutely didn't do any of that. If you have more interest in going into this, there's an article I'll link to on the Smithsonian called Lewis Carroll's Shifting Reputation. History.com sums up their thoughts in one sentence, saying, despite conjecture, little evidence of child abuse can be brought against him.
Little evidence or no evidence?
I think that a lot of people say
evidence.
A lot of people are saying none. Some people are saying some, and then it does seem like it all started in the 1930s.
From what you're saying, this has all come from some old quacky science, maybe
potentially.
That's where it absolutely all started. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's strange. Okay. Oh, you'd be furious.
Oh, absolutely.
Wouldn't you be furious if your reputation was tarnished by that?
Yeah, like 3 decades after he died. And when he died, he was, seen with... He had a great reputation.
He was beloved.
But that aside, whatever the reputation of the author, the classic, like you say, Matt, the work has remained unscathed and is still a classic of children's literature. It's been adapted for TV and film over 20 times. Over a couple of dozen now. So, yeah. Shall we crack into Alice's Adventures in Wonderland?
Oh, yeah, we haven't even started the book yet.
Yeah, I know.
Does it normally take this long?
Well, sometimes.
Sorry, we talked a lot about sleep. That's my bad. Sorry, everyone.
Now, always start with the opening line to give a bit of context, and that is the opening line of Chapter 1, Down the Rabbit Hole. Alice was beginning to get very tired of sitting by her sister on the bank and of having nothing to do. Once or twice, she had peeped into the book her sister was reading, but had no pictures or conversation in it. And what is the use of a book, thought Alice, without pictures or conversations? And we're off.
Strong start.
I understood all those words. That's a good start.
Fingle fongle? No, none of that. So Alice is super bored when a rabbit runs past and she hears him say, oh dear, I shall be late.
Oh, that's from the book. That you reckon they use that in most of the adaptations?
Yeah, it's a sense memory, that.
A sense memory. What does that mean?
Oh, as in just hearing those words, oh dear, I'm late. I can picture the rabbit. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, I know that rabbit. That's the mad. That's the mad rabbit. Is that what they call him? Mad rabbit.
I think most of the characters are mad.
Right. Okay.
There's the Mad Hatter.
Mad Hatter. Right. Yes. Anyway, sorry, Dave. Please continue.
But we get straight into it. Like straight away. Like there's that opening sentence about the real word, and then she sees a rabbit. So there's no sort of building up to it. We're straight into this world. And Alice decides to follow the rabbit, who also has a pocket watch. So it speaks English. It's got a watch. We know something's up with this rabbit. The rabbit eventually disappears down a rabbit hole, and Alice follows him there. And when she does so, she finds herself falling and falling for ages, like she's in a long tunnel or a vortex or something. And there's cupboards all around her, one of which has an empty jar of marmalade in it, and she's got time to grab it. And then she's falling for so long, she's got time to daydream and sort of get bored of falling. She starts thinking about her cat, Before
is this the K-hole sort of? Is that what it feels seriously? Like? King?
Yeah, I mean, usually a little bit more sleepy than this, but yeah, you know.
And eventually she lands, uninjured. She sees the rabbit again disappearing around a corner, so she goes after him. And she finds herself in a corridor of locked doors, but she also spies a key on a glass table. Mm. She's like, maybe this key's going to unlock one of these doors, so she tries it in all the doors, but it doesn't fit any of the locks. That is, until she tries it in a tiny door behind a curtain. And it works, and on the other side, she spies a lovely, lush garden. She'd love to go and check it out, but she's way too big to fit through the door. So she can't get in there.
Damn it.
Obviously a relatable problem.
Mm. Have you ever been too big for a door?
Oh, so all the time, you know?
I can't think of a time when I couldn't fit through a door. Usually doors are basically... Oh, maybe getting into a car sometimes. You feel like... Do you ever get into a real small car and you're like...
So at the front of where I live... The nature strip is sort of raised a bit. And if you park too close to it, when you open the door digs into the grass and you can't open it anymore. And it's worse when if you get into the car and you sneak in, your weight on that side of the vehicle makes it go down.
Pulls the car down.
And then you can't even close the door. You're sort of digging all this dirt. So, yes.
Yeah, no, 100%. 100%.
I have not been able to get into a car. Yeah. So she's bummed. She can't get into the can't get through the door. But she puts the key back on the table and spies a bottle that wasn't there before, and it's labelled "Drink Me," which, as a PSA to any kids listening, is not a good idea to follow that instruction.
Far out. That's another great question. Have you ever drunk something that said "Drink Me" on it? Have you ever seen something? I reckon I've. Have you ever listened to a label to drink something? I don't think I ever have.
Oh, I feel like there's a bunch of like sassy oat milk like. Cartons now that say stuff like "Drink Me" and
oh sure
stuff like that.
But if someone like Matt, for example, if you walked into if you're at a party, right, and you wander away from the main party into the kitchen, and then on the kitchen bench there was just a jar with say a blue liquid in it and some tape on it that said "Drink Me," would you drink it?
What are you offering me?
No, you're alone. You're alone at this party, and it just says "Drink Me." Would you have a sip?
Wait, well, what is it? Does it just say "Drink Me"? Does it say "Drink Me, Matt Stewart"?
Oh, good question.
It says "Drink Me," or it says like maybe there's like 10 jars, and they all say "Drink Me." So it's not, you know. So you're not taking the only one
at a house party.
Yeah,
yeah, I'd probably drink that.
Would you drink it, Dave?
If it said "Drink Me, Matt Stewart"? yeah, just a spot him.
It doesn't say "Drink Me." It just says "Matt's" on it.
Matt's. Yeah, he would.
Don't
mind.
Touch. Don't drink. Yeah.
I don't think I would. Would you drink it, Hing?
I think I would drink it. I would drink it.
Drink
me.
It would probably depend on the party a little bit. Some parties, I'd ask a few more questions.
If you're deep in the K-hole, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But she does drink it. She absolutely drinks it. And she finds herself shrinking smaller and smaller and smaller until she's small enough to fit through that garden door.
How lucky is that?
Amazing.
Right? You know, just when she needed it, she's got the drink that's perfect for the scenario. Do we know if that drink would have shrunk no matter what, or is the drink doing what she needed at that time?
It feels like it was put there for her, because it wasn't there when she didn't need it. And then she realizes, oh, I'd love to get through there, but I'm not small enough. And then...
Is this that Deus Ex Machina or whatever?
Deus Ex Machina.
Oh, you pretty, you know.
The ghost in the machine. I feel like the ghost in the machine usually comes towards the end of the book. It doesn't come, you know, four pages in.
Throwing the hand of God around at every opportunity.
Imagine if you've only got one Deus Ex Machina and you use it right at the start.
Oh, blew
and then
it
by off. the end of the book, everything's complicated. You wish you could just hand wave it away, but it's just we already used that one back at the start.
But you would be bummed if you went early, because she realizes that now she's small, she's left the key on the table, which is now way out of her tiny reach, so she can't get the key to open the door, which is locked again. She starts crying before finding a small cake under the table that says "Eat Me," and you'll never believe what she does next.
That's fun.
She eats it, and she begins to grow and grow until she's so big her head hits the ceiling. And she starts crying again. Because she's so big now, she's a giant. Her tears create a small river in the hallway around her. Then the stressed-out white rabbit reappears and mutters to himself about keeping a duchess waiting. And he rushes off again, but not before leaving a fan behind, a little handheld fan, that Alice starts using. And this causes her to get small again, and she uses it to get down to the size of the garden door. Her priority seems to not be getting home at this point. It's about getting through that little door. That's all she cares about. She also has, at this stage, a bit of an identity crisis because she can't remember an old saying, an old poem that she's sure she should know. And then she starts thinking, maybe I'm not Alice. Maybe I'm a much dumber girl I know called Mabel, because Mabel definitely doesn't know this saying.
Have we heard much? Do we ever find more out about Mabel? I want to hear about this dumb idiot Mabel.
Sadly, that's all we hear about Mabel. It's just that, oh, Mabel's dumb and doesn't know this poem. Maybe I'm her. Maybe I'm Mabel.
Stupid Mabel.
So now Alice is small again. She's tiny. She gets washed away by her own river of tears that she cried when she was a giant. And as she's pulled into the current, she sees a mouse that she offends by mentioning her cat. But eventually it helps her swim to shore.
Ooh. Wait. Oh. She offends a mouse.
Yeah, by mentioning, she's like, oh, I'm sure this
cat. Was it the mouse's ex or something? Well, how dare you bring them up here?
Can you imagine, though, if you were a mouse or a cat and you were in a relationship and then you broke up, everyone you know would be like, I told you that cat was bad news. Like, all the cats would be like, that you should never have dated the mouse. That's mortal enemies, you know what I mean?
That's true. It would have been a surprising pair-off. A real star-crossed lover sort of stuff. Dave, that's a reference to Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, I thought it was a reference to Hamlet.
Fuck, is it?
No. No, I just knew that would make you freak out.
Damn it. Very quick to second guess. Don't use that knowledge against me, Dave.
I'll never do that again. So now she's out of the river. She's on the bank because the mouse that used to date a cat helped her out. And there's a bunch of animals around, like a bird, like lots of birds and a crab.
Are these noteworthy? There's just lots of animals. I reckon in so many stories there'd be a bird around. they're in the woods or something.
They're on the bank. They're hanging out with a crab. It's a weird assortment of animals.
Okay. Right, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't think any of this made it into any of the movies I've seen.
You don't remember the crab? Or a bird?
No. The crab or the mouse and the cat? Forbidden lovers?
They've all been in the river of tears and are freaking out about how to get dry. Which is weird for a crab.
The river of tears definitely rings a bell, though.
You think of that. It's weird for a crab to freak out about getting wet, isn't it, though? But anyway, he's freaking out with the birds, I guess. And the mouse tries to get them dry by giving them a very dry lecture on William the Conqueror.
Is that punnery there?
Yeah,
though?
A bit of fun.
Your favourite.
There's quite a few puns in this book. A lot of wordplay.
A kid's getting that kind of joke?
No, it's like Shrek. There's some jokes for the adults as well, you know?
That one's for Dad.
Dad loves William the Conqueror gear. Loves it. Again, Alice upsets all the animals by mentioning her cat and they all leave. So it seems like this cat has many exes. They're all offended when she brings it up. The white rabbit appears again and mistakes Alice for his maidservant and orders her to go into a house and retrieve some gloves and a fan that he's misplaced. That's because he put them down before. And inside, she finds another little bottle labelled, Drink Me.
Oh, now you'd be getting cocky with it, wouldn't
you? This feels like a crutch, to be honest. This feels like a literary crutch.
And not having learned her lesson, she drinks from it, immediately beginning to grow again. And she's inside a house and her hands dangle through the house window and she gets stuck inside, her foot gets stuck in the chimney. She's way too big for this house. And the rabbit gets annoyed. And when it can't get into the house, because Alice has filled it up, a crowd gathers and starts sort of talking about wanting to burn it down because there's this weird giant woman inside.
Ooh.
And the riotous mob start to throw stones, but they turn into cakes. And Alice actually eats one. And then she shrinks again and is able to leave the house. Would you put that as part of the crutch or is a stone turning into a cake? Is that better?
Well, it just feels like there's a lot of ingestion of it's like sort of ingestion and then size, ingestion then size. That feels like the thing that the theme.
Can you, can you imagine the stretch marks? Unbelievable. Going up, going down.
Would you rather be 4 times bigger than you are or 4 times smaller than you are?
Oh.
So you're either a quarter of the size you are now. So, I don't know, you'd be like, what, 1.5 feet tall or something, because you're probably about 6 foot now or something like that.
Thank you.
You'd be a quarter of that, or you'd be like, what, 24 foot tall.
At first, my first instinct was go big because you could play basketball or whatever, make a good living.
Sure.
But that's definitely not, I think definitely a quarter of the size.
If you were 24 feet tall, you what house could you live in?
Yeah, exactly.
It would be 8 meters tall or something. You couldn't. It'd be a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't fall for your trap. Nice
so
try.
You'd go small.
Yeah.
Dave, would you also go small?
No, why not? I'm going to go big. I'll just get a big house. I'm a big man.
What do you mean you just get a big house?
I'll get a big house. I'll get a big car.
How are you going to get a big house?
I'm a big man. People.
Will you sell tickets to see the big man?
Yeah, that's right. I work 1 hour a day. Come see the big man. And the rest of the day, I'm just in my big man house.
Would you still do stand-up? Would you do stand-up comedy as a 20-foot tall man? Yeah, 24-foot tall
man. But I only do it in outdoor venues, which is very COVID safe. So I'd be killing it.
It's actually great now.
I'd be killing it.
Yeah, any of your sort of your sprayed particles or whatever they are would be going way over their heads anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
All the droplets. Yeah. That's quite funny because, you know, if you did like if you ended up getting so famous you'd do it a stadium arena tour, they'd have the big screens next to you, but those big screens would be smaller than you.
That's just so you can look at me with just within just a line of sight.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to look up and
scanning
down.
Scanning me.
To get Dave's.
Hing, what would you pick, Hing? Would you go big or small?
I would. I think I'd go small. I'd go little. Yeah, I'd like to be a little guy. Yeah,
I'd carry you both around. That'd be fun. One under each arm.
If you're that big, sort of we can be pocket size for you for a giant.
Yeah,
I can't. I'm not fully picturing how big you are, but it's huge. And I'm also. I just realized I'm picturing you getting taller, but no other proportions changing. So just stretching out.
Ooh.
Real lanky stick man.
I'm up for it.
Okay, great.
I would drink the potion that said, if it said drink me, to get 8 meters tall. So Alice, she wanders around. She comes upon a mushroom and sitting on it is a blue caterpillar smoking a hookah pipe.
Ah, oh, yes, remember that. Remember the caterpillar? Mm-hmm. The opium caterpillar, I remember.
Yeah, he's sucking it down, and the caterpillar questions Alice, who begins to admit to her current identity crisis, compounded by inability to remember that poem. Remember, she might be Mabel. We're not sure.
Mm.
But before crawling away, the caterpillar tells Alice that one side of the mushroom he's sitting on will make her taller, and the other side will make her shorter. So
always size with this guy. There's constant more. Size changing. Get a new joke.
For the psychoanalyst here, what's I don't understand where he's found these things.
Mm.
Her getting bigger and smaller?
Maybe it comes later. Maybe it wasn't in the first 4 pages of the book or whatever.
Wait, are we only 4 pages in?
I don't know.
Dave.
No, we're about halfway through. It's quite a short story.
We're halfway through.
Well, Matt, we're 5 chapters of 12 in.
Hing, do you want me to recap? So she went down the thing. She saw White Rabbit. That, I looked at that name of that rabbit's White Rabbit. So that's where Eminem got his name, I guess. And then she went down the hole real slow. And then she got big and small and big and small.
Big and small, each of them is a chapter. I assumed that it was happening in one chapter. But big is a chapter and small is a chapter and then big. Okay.
Yeah, basically.
Right.
And so she's been told, hey, if you eat this side of the one side of this mushroom will make you taller, one side will make you smaller. I won't tell you which one. And then the caterpillar goes away. So she breaks off 2 pieces from the mushroom and she sort of nibbles them. And one side makes her shrink smaller than ever, whilst another causes her neck to grow so high that she goes into the trees. She's got a 9-foot tall neck.
So now she's going to have, she's sort of now having to nibble one and the other to even it out, kind of like when you're trying to do your sideburns.
Yeah. Exactly. Do you think that's what he was trying to say in this bit? If you're cycling along,
I've overcorrected. Yeah, I think so. I think this is a sideburn. He'd just done his sideburns. Took him ages. Then he converted into this mushroom thing.
But you're so right. She's so large, she has to convince a dive-bombing pigeon that she's not a serpent. Because she's up in the clouds. But she eats the other side of the mushroom and Alice gets back to her normal height. So now at least she can control how big she wants to be. She's got this sort of mechanism. So we don't...
Imagine this pigeon dive-bombing. You're like, I don't have time for this. I'm not a serpent. I don't want to have to convince... I don't have to convince you of this. I'm clearly a person who's... just now grown up into the trees. Okay?
So wait, so now you're annoyed at having the indignity of having to prove your humanity.
Yeah.
To a bird.
To a bird.
To a bird of all people. A bird.
Yeah. I'm clearly just a young girl with a 9-foot tall neck who might be Alice, who might be Mabel. That's clearly who I am.
Now, Dave, you've said 9-foot tall neck twice now. Are you saying the neck is at 9 feet height? Or is just the portion of the body that is the neck has elongated to 9 feet?
Yeah, the neck.
Then surely the dive-bombing pigeon would be going, are you a giraffe, not a serpent?
Yeah, exactly. How dumb is this pigeon?
I mean, how dumb are all pigeons?
It's true. They seem very stupid.
Yeah.
But on a scale of 1 to Mabel, I'm not sure. She arrives at a house and decides to let herself in after the doorman just speaks gibberish to her. And inside, it's... the Duchess's house. The Duchess's cook is throwing dishes and making a soup that has so much pepper in it that everyone is sneezing violently, including the Duchess and her baby. Now, the only one not to sneeze is another famous character, the Cheshire Cat.
Oh, yes,
the Cheshire Cat. Yes.
I think in my head I've sort of merged the caterpillar and the Cheshire Cat together. They're both sort of smarmy wise guys, is that right?
Yeah, well, the cat does do a bit of talking, but it also does a lot of watching on and just smiling.
Right.
Mm. And the Cheshire Cat also, I think in the movie, does a lot of like blending into the background and camouflage and appearing here and there.
Yeah, so it sort of disappears, but the smile is usually still remaining.
Yeah.
And that happens in the book too, so that is faithful to the book. Alice, she's never seen a cat smile before. She's very surprised. She's also very surprised that the cook hurls objects randomly at the Duchess and the baby, including saucepans and plates. But no one else seems fazed by this, by the cook just throwing shit at a baby. Eventually, the Duchess gives the baby to Alice, and whilst holding onto the baby, it turns into a pig. So she just puts it down, and then the pig just trots off. We don't know what happens to the pig / baby.
This feels like, it just does, it feels like a trip. It feels like a long...
100%.
It is just a sequence of strange scenes.
Yeah. And a classic book.
Yeah.
Who's the antagonist in this? It's hard to tell who the antagonist is. Like, the protagonist is clearly Alice. Who's the baddie? Who's the villain?
Oh, we've got a villain coming up.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Jabberwocky? Is that something?
Not this time.
Oh. That's from the sequel.
The sequel.
Have we talked about this already? Is this what Hing was talking about before?
Yeah.
Potentially.
That's the poem that Grandma Hing knew off by heart.
That was Jabberwocky.
Great grandma.
And that is not the baddie, though. There you go.
Not this time, but we've got a baddie coming up. And I'm pretty sure you'll realise who it is. Mostly from her catchphrase, which we'll get to. But before that...
Oh, yes.
Mm.
Oof. Does it start with oof?
Yes, it does.
Little sizzle there.
Little sizzle for about 2 chapters' time. Anyway, we're burning through this. The Cheshire Cat then reappears in a tree and tells... So he's obviously got a bit of magic going on. This guy can disappear and reappear. He tells her to visit the Mad Hatter and the March Hare, but warns her that they are both mad, which is probably indicated by the fact that the man's name is Mad Hatter, but... The cat tells her that he will catch up with her later at the Queen's croquet match before disappearing. That is, his body disappears, but his grin remains behind to float on its own in the air, prompting Alice to remark that she's now often seen a cat without a grin, but never a grin without a cat. Bit of fun there.
Wow. What a witticism from Alice.
She looks around and no one was there to hear it.
Huh?
Damn it. Write that down.
It's funny that the Mad Hatter in my head plays a much bigger part in this book. We're well over halfway through it and he hasn't appeared.
He's basically got one scene. It's this chapter, chapter 7, a mad tea party.
Yeah, this is one of the iconic bits.
Mm.
So she continues on her way and comes across a large table under a tree. It's set up for a tea party. Lots of places set. Lots of people could sit there. But Alice is told that there's no room for her. But she sits down anyway and joins the mad tea party along with the March Hare, the Mad Hatter, and a very tired Dormouse, who falls asleep frequently, only to be violently awakened moments later by the March Hare and the Mad Hatter.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mad Hatter, he loves giving Alice riddles, including the first one, which is the most famous one. He says, "Why is a raven like a writing desk?"
I don't know.
Why is a raven like a writing desk?
Any ideas on this one?
Do ravens send messages? No, that's Game of Thrones. That's Game of Thrones. I don't know.
Well, after a lot of frustration, Alice also gives up, only to find out that the Mad Hatter doesn't know either. So he's just spewing out these nonsense riddles with no answer.
Infuriating. Truly infuriating. Yeah.
And Dave, you just recreated that infuriating behavior by asking us to solve it.
Yeah, I know.
That is true, Dave.
Answer.
You did do that.
I knew there was no answer. Sorry, not sorry.
The whole time you knew.
The Hatter reveals that they have tea all day long because time has punished him by eternally standing still at 6 p.m., which for him is tea time. So he's got to constantly have a tea party.
Wow, that's a little bit dystopian, isn't it? I didn't realize that he was stuck in purgatory like that.
And that's how he got mad, is it?
Yeah, I think, and it seems like he's going madder and madder over time.
I reckon what I would do with that is for sure have tea, but then, you know, have a 6 o'clock nap. You can do other things at 6 o'clock.
Oh, you'd use this as a way to empower yourself over time rather than be trapped at 6 o'clock habits.
Now you can just do whatever you like. 6 o'clock is whatever you make of it.
6 p.m. brunch. Love it.
Love it. Just live your life. And now you've got, you know, you've got an unlimited one. That's a gift.
Or if this is the 90s, you could chuck on Channel 10 and watch The Simpsons over and over again.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I guess it would only ever be starting though, wouldn't it? It's never even moving a minute.
Yeah, what if it's just 6 o'clock? Is it always just that exact second, or do you get like half
it's just
an hour?
What is the show?
It's cloudy. I know that.
Yeah, this cloudy program. It's in Dolby
it's
surround
show about
sound.
The sky, but... I guess.
Alice becomes eventually insulted and tired of being bombarded with riddles, and she leaves the tea party, saying it is the stupidest tea party that she's ever been to. And honestly, I do not doubt it.
I mean, she's a child. How many tea parties has she been to?
Alice out here leaving TripAdvisor reviews on the tea party.
One star.
One star. Stupidest tea party I've ever been to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, book cheaters, just Dave here to let you know that this week's episode is brought to you by Audible, the leading provider of spoken word entertainment all in one place. At Audible, you can find the largest selection of audiobooks ranging from bestsellers, new releases to celebrity memoirs, language stuff, business motivation, all sorts of original entertainment from top celebrity creators and thousands of popular and binge-worthy podcasts. If you are an Audible member like me, you get one credit every month, good for any title in their premium selection. That means the latest bestsellers, Buzzy's new releases, so much to choose from. They're yours to keep forever in your Audible library. And you also get access to their popular Plus catalog, which is filled with thousands and thousands of audiobooks, original entertainment, guided fitness and meditation, sleep tracks for better rest, and podcasts. And they're all included with your memberships. So you can download or stream as much as you want. And included in the popular Plus catalog is Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, narrated by Jodie Comer, who some of you might know from Killing Eve. I've listened to it and it's a very, very good performance. She does all the voices very, very well. Brought the book to life in a whole new way for me. But the other thing I've been listening to this month, the thing that I use my credit for, is on a history audiobook. Now, some of you will know I'm a bit of a history nerd. I've been loving The Hollow Crown by Dan Jones, an English writer and historian who's written this amazing book on the Wars of the Roses. Could not recommend that enough. So if you want to get involved and check out Audible, new members can try it free for 30 days. And all you have to do is go to audible.com/bookcheat or text bookcheat to 500-500. One more time, go to audible.com/bookcheat or text bookcheat to 500-500. Thanks, Audible. So she leaves the tea party. She finds herself back in the Hall of Doors where she started this whole adventure.
Back to the old Hall of Doors.
Well, well, well.
And this is the old Hall of Doors.
She's got the mushroom with her. So she uses it to grow big enough to grab the key off the table, then eats the shrinking mushroom to get small enough to get through the door to that beautiful garden that she's obsessed with.
That's clever that she kept the mushroom with her. Very clever. She's basically now got Ant-Man powers until she runs out of the mushrooms.
Alice in Wonderland, the original Ant-Man.
If she trains with it, she could do that. You know, run, jump, take a bite, shrink down, go through the keyhole, take a bite of the other one, and land.
So now you want her to speed run this.
I don't think she's having fun there. Everyone's a nightmare. Every person she's met, an animal, they've all been absolute nightmares.
And the nightmare has only just begun. Because she goes through to this garden that she's obsessed with seeing. Yes, it's beautiful in there, but things are just as weird as they are everywhere else in this world. She comes upon three living playing cards, painting the white roses on a rose tree because, quote, the Queen of Hearts hates white roses.
Oh.
So they're literal like playing cards with numbers and symbols on them.
So I reckon so much of this story is, I assume they took some liberties with the TV and film version I've seen, but this is all exactly like them.
Yeah.
If they play croquet with birds,
flamingos right?
instead of sticks, and I'm not sure what Walt Disney did.
Well, I guess like Walt Disney, I mean, look, it far be from me to defend Walt Disney, but Walt Disney did animate it. That's okay. Something.
Yeah, that's true.
I would argue that is necessary for a cartoon movie.
That is a good point.
It's a load-bearing skill.
So a procession of more playing cards, including kings and queens, and even the white rabbit we saw way back at the start, enters the garden. And Alice then meets the king and queen. That is the King and Queen of Hearts. And it turns out the Queen of Hearts is absolutely unhinged. And if anything or anyone even slightly annoys her, she says, off with his head or off with its head.
Oh, classic. Yes.
And she says this over and over and over again. And we realize quickly it's a trademark catchphrase, sentencing people to death left, right and center.
She loves it. She absolutely loves it.
Absolutely loves it. Alice is invited to play a game of croquet with the Queen. And Alice joins basically out of fear for her own head. And Alice, she's played croquet before, but never like this. This one has live flamingos as mallets and hedgehogs as balls.
Oh, there you go.
The Cheshire Cat then appears as a floating head. And the Queen of Hearts says, off with his head. But the executioner comes in and complains and says, it's impossible since the head is all that can be seen. What am I removing it from? It's already a head. Bit of fun. And I'll come clean and say I'm skipping a couple of chapters here because Alice meets some more strange animals, including it's just scene after scene, including the mock turtle, who I like because he asks Alice, oh, you go to school? oh, yeah, I used to go to school. And he reminisces and he says, oh, our teacher's name was Tortoise. And Alice asks, why would they call the teacher that if he's clearly a turtle? And the turtle replies, because he taught us.
Oh, boy.
Bit of wordplay oh, there? Boy. Bit of wordplay?
I'm thinking I'm glad you're going to skip those chapters, Dave.
That's the highlight. That is the highlight.
Does she meet up with the crab again? Do we ever get to see the crab again?
No, they talk about lobsters, but not the crab.
Oh, what do they say about lobsters? I'd be keen to know. I'm a lobster enthusiast myself.
Are you really into lobsters? There's this whole poetic section.
Huh. There was a time, Dave, where there was 6 months or so before the pandemic, middle of 2019, 6 months where I did stand-up comedy exclusively dressed as a lobster. That's how into lobsters I am.
Why were you doing that?
I was having what I, in retrospect, can recognize was a mental breakdown, but at the time was a series of strong artistic choices.
Were you doing lobster gear?
I had like material about being a lobster. Basically, what happened was I was working at a show called The Feed at SBS, which is a wonderful program, and I was doing a lot of daily videos and comedy about politics and the real world. And, you know, I don't know if you remember 2018, 2019, but it wasn't as bad as it is now, but it was still pretty bad. And so every day I was just going into work and trying to do, like, quote unquote comedy, but like the most horrifying things in the world, and trying to make them funny in the way like modern comedy has to be political or whatever. And it drove me mad. And so when I did stand up, I wanted to separate myself entirely from reality. And so I started dressing as a lobster and had a lobster costume and a big head that I had at the back of my car. So whenever I did comedy for like 6 months, I just dressed as a lobster. And I will tell you both, the most fun I've ever had doing comedy, and also never had a good gig, basically. Just bombed gig after gig for 6 months, dressed as a lobster, baffling the audience.
People are like, oh, great. Michael Hingham, I love his work on SBS.
No, for real. It would often be like
TV, turn up. They're like, what the hell?
I did a fringe show where I advertised it as like, I'll probably dress as a lobster and talk for about an hour. And people were like, lol, that's one of Hing's crazy jokes. There's no way he'll do that. And then people turned up and some nights I got booed. Like literally people were like, take off the lobster costume. What are you doing?
Oh my God.
I remember this now. I remember seeing these photos. I'm just looking them up. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, that feels like a different lifetime.
It feels like years and years ago. It was at least 6 lockdowns ago for you.
Oh, wow. If you Google Michael Hing lobster, I'm seeing exactly what you were doing. Would you wear this head over your face? Could we see your face?
Yeah.
muffled sounds coming out.
Yeah, because the mouth of the lobster costume is actually where your eyes are.
Right.
So you see at the mouth. And so you've really got to shout. So then eventually for the French show, what I had to do was like wear basically a TV microphone. Like I had to tape onto my chest and then plug that into the desk, and then it was amplified that way. And I just held a stand-up microphone as like a prop, really. Anyway, the whole thing was a commercial failure.
Are you sure that when Sydney opens up again and you hit the stage, will you be dressed as a lobster?
Hard to tell. There's nothing I would like more than to go back to doing lobster comedy. but again, I just don't know if Australia and indeed the world is ready or to accept me as a lobster.
I love it. I support your artistic choice.
Thank you.
Maybe it's just not the right animal. Like, have you thought about trying another animal? Like, if you return and you're just like, I don't know, a squirrel or something.
Yeah, I have. The reason I like lobster, I had something of a pre-existing interest in lobsters prior to the breakdown on account of a series of essays that I read about lobsters that I quite liked. So there was at least a basis for the material. I think if I had to go with squirrel, I'd have to start from scratch again, and I don't know that I could build up the knowledge base sufficient to do an hour of stand-up comedy in character.
Plus, you've already got the lobster costume.
Exactly. It cost me $280 from Alibaba, you know?
Okay. That's some serious outlay. Well, I'm so sorry that I didn't really pay attention to the lobster gear in the book. I found it was there was all this poem about a lobster. It was quite dull, to be honest, in this book. Sorry about that.
Were you getting paid many lobsters for these gigs?
I reckon I did. There was one particular venue in Sydney that I performed as a lobster in, and they asked me to not do that bit ever again. and that's like one of the few good paying gigs in Sydney, so I did return to being me at that venue.
How did that conversation go?
Oh, the manager, that's just the booker, was like, hey, that bombed. Can you not do that next time? And I was like, fair enough.
Oh, no. It's breaking my heart.
Like, you kind of understand. Like, you know, you kind of understand. Like, it was just baffling for the audience, because I would also demand that the MC not bring me on as a lobster, because I thought that was cheapening the act. I was like, you have to bring me on as Michael Hing, and just so you know, I will be dressed as a lobster, but I don't want you to mention it. And that was part of the rules I'd set up for the bit. Anyway, none of this is good.
Do you think there's an alternative reality where you became the most successful comedian of all time?
Absolutely. I'm the Carl Barron of that world.
Lobster guy, you sell like 3 million DVDs.
God, if only.
Well, we're approaching the end of the book because Alice is whisked away to a courtroom to attend the trial of the Knave of Hearts, who was accused of stealing the Queen's tarts. I did not know that knave is another word for jack, so it's the Jack of Hearts is on trial.
Oh.
The jury is composed of various animals that we've met throughout the book, and the judge is the King of Hearts. One of the jurors is a lizard named Bill, who is taking notes with a pencil that squeaks, and it annoys Alice so much that she grabs it when he's not looking and hides it. And this is so sad to me, quote from the book, "She did it so quickly that the poor little juror could not make out at all what had become of it. So after hunting all about for it, he was obliged to write with one finger for the rest of the day. And this was of very little use, as it left no mark on the slate." So this little lizard's just taking notes that mean nothing because he's lost his little pencil.
I guess that's the futility. Like, this book really seems to relish futility, you know? It's like the Mad Hatter who's always stuck at 6 o'clock, you know? Or the lizard who's now writing with a finger that doesn't leave a mark. Yeah. It's just futility and
they're getting pointlessness. Nowhere.
It's kind of it's like a Samuel Beckett play, you know? It's like Waiting for Godot or something. You know, the torture of being, of existence.
It never arrives. During the proceedings, Alice finds that she is steadily growing larger. So she's been small enough in this garden the whole time, but now she's getting bigger and bigger. A few witnesses are called, including the Mad Hatter, who displeases and frustrates the king through his indirect answers to the questions. Again, the trial is absolute nonsense. Nothing makes any sense. Everyone is confused. The queen is trying to work out the sentence before the verdict is given. Basically, she just wants to cut everyone's heads off. But Alice is also told that it's all her fancy, that they never execute nobody, you know? So no one is actually being executed, according to one of the characters. The queen I think that's her way of being all powerful, but then people are like, yes, ma'am, no worries, we'll kill them, and then they just sort of take them away.
Oh, that's nice. Guess it is a kid's book.
Yeah. Otherwise, there's a lot of head chopping, a lot of execution for a kid's book.
Yeah, and he goes into great detail.
Was executions would have been quite commonplace in 1865 or whatever, I imagine. They're probably still doing hangings and whatnot.
Yeah.
So, and when they did that, wasn't that a thing, like the whole family had gone and just watched the state, like, end someone's life? That was like a thing people would go and watch back in the day?
Like a grand day out.
Yeah. It is my belief that everything that happened before 2005 was basically horrible.
Yeah, I feel that. Something about England as well. 1800s England, it just feels it's black and white. It's sooty. Yeah, there's a lot of soot around, you know?
You know, it's when Oliver's set. That's, yeah. You know, that's real grubby.
A lot of workhouses.
Yeah.
No good.
Gruel.
Yeah, gruel. Oh.
Gruel. It's all gruel.
It's gruel central. Alice is very surprised when she herself is called up as a witness in the trial. She forgets how big she's grown now because she's been growing steadily throughout this whole trial. And she accidentally knocks over the jury box with the animals inside. And she has to put them all back. And she puts one of them back upside down and his legs are sticking out.
Really, at this point, she's being polite letting them have this trial. She could now stomp on them, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's...
Yes.
I'll do your little trial, but... Just know, you're not lopping this head.
Good luck to you. Well, the king and queen order Alice to leave. They get annoyed at it, citing Rule 42, which is all persons more than a mile high to leave the court.
She's a mile high now? A mile high?
No, she's in the mile high club.
She disputes the rule on two grounds. Number one, I am not a mile high. Number two, that is a stupid rule. The king says, it's the oldest rule in the book, to which Alice replies, if it was the oldest rule, it would be rule number one, not rule number 42.
Wow. Hmm? Wow. Maybe they appealed rules 1 through 41 because they realised that they were quite problematic. Like they realised they weren't very progressive, they were racist or sexist or homophobic in some way, so they had to be repealed. So it's the oldest remaining law in the book, potentially.
That, honestly, could be true. But she argues with the king and queen over the ridiculous proceedings, and the queen, who only knows how to deal with things in one way, shouts, off with her head.
Wow, the queen's going to kill a kid. That's real full on.
A giant kid. But Alice, who's much, much larger than all those around her, she's unafraid. She says, you're nothing but a pack of cards. And the cards do not take kindly to this and attack Alice, jumping on her. And she pushes them off at first, but soon they're swarming all over her. And it's at this point, Alice's sister wakes her up. That's right, it was a dream.
No. Really, the whole thing was a dream?
Yeah.
Oh, that's infuriating. I hate that.
That sucks.
I hate that so much.
Maybe this wasn't a hack move in 1865, you know?
I reckon it was. Wasn't. I reckon it's all a dream has been around forever. But like, yeah, because all a dream was in the Bible, you know? So it has to be one of the oldest.
You know what? He's realized that he's used his hand of God.
Oh, early. That's exactly what's happened. He used his deus ex machina on the potion that made her big or small. And now he's got to the end. There's all this stuff going on. And he does it's all a dream. Oh, God. Yeah, nothing's...
Oh, that was really unsatisfying.
Yeah, I'm
going to
be honest,
though.
The best thing he ever did was Jabberwocky. Everything else sucks.
Well, there's a bit more. There's a bit more.
Oh, okay.
But it will not satisfy you. So she's brushing leaves off her face, not playing cards. That's what she's feeling in her face. Alice tells her sister about her dream and all she can remember from it, so she retells the story. Then she runs off, leaving her sister on the bank of the river, who starts daydreaming about what she's heard. She thinks of the characters like the white rabbit and the lizard with the squeaky pencil, all that sort of stuff. Lastly, she thinks of Alice telling these stories when she grows up, and this is the final line of the book. Lastly, she pictured to herself how this same little sister of hers would, in the aftertime, be herself a grown-up woman, and how she would keep, through all her riper years, the simple and loving heart of her childhood, and how she would gather about other little children, and make their eyes bright and eager with many a strange tale, perhaps even with the dream of Wonderland of long ago, and how she would feel with all their simple sorrows and find a pleasure in all their simple joys, remembering her own child life and the happy summer days. The end.
Yeah, that really wasn't satisfying. I think maybe... I mean, are we reviewing this, Dave? Or
I'd love to know what your thoughts are on the story, on its meaning, which has been speculated about in all sorts of ways. I'll just say, people have analysed it. They've said, was he sexually repressed? Is it an allegory? Is it satirising people of the time? Was there some mathematical meaning, people have said, because he was a mathematician and apparently there were some hidden messages in there. Was he a Marxist? All this sort of stuff very early on. Mm. Any feelings on if it has any meaning?
I don't know if the actual book has any meaning, but I could not glean a deeper meaning from your summary of it. And I feel like any meaning that I would have been able to glean from that would have to have been imposed through your telling. So I feel like really that's on you, Dave.
That's right. Sorry, I didn't put any hidden mathematical meanings in
there. Yeah.
if there's any slightly hidden second story, it's that she was on a bender.
Yeah.
And, like, she's eating, she's having edibles, she's drinking, and she's, you know, tripping. That's all, that's what it feels like. Certainly. I don't, and that's from your retelling and the films that I've seen and stuff. That's all, I'd be interested to hear what the theories are of deeper meaning than that.
Well, I'll say, according to our good friends at Britannica, they write, "The book is not an allegory. It has no hidden meaning or message, either religious, political, or psychological, as some have tried to prove, and its only undertones are some touches of gentle satire on education for the children's special benefit and on familiar university types, whom the Littles may or may not have recognised." And that's the people that he wrote the story about initially.
Right, right. So
they say, but over the 150 years, it's been analysed in nearly every possible way.
It feels like the kind of book with all these different characters, you could, it feels like the kind of story you could put whatever meaning onto it you
want
to.
Yeah, I think so too.
Oh, the lobster. Yeah, well, the lobster represents the patriarchy. You know, like, that's my go-to word when I'm trying to sound smart. it's a dichotomy, I think you can see, with the River of Tears. The dry land being democracy.
And?
Egalitarianism is represented by the rabbit. And the cards,
famously,
man, the seven deadly sins.
I agree with that.
Why are you guys leaving me out here to dry? It's no good. I feel like a bloody retelling of that play that was dry. Hing, you're the smarter one here of the two guests. What do you think about
stuff? I could not glean a meaning, as I said. I think that the story needed...
No argument there, by the way, from Hing. Did not even for a moment hesitate on that.
What?
That you're the smarter
of
the two of
us. Thought... I mean, fair enough. You said it with such dryness in your voice. I assumed that if I was to engage in it, I would only be ridiculed, Matt. That's kind of, honestly, that's how I felt. So I thought best to sidestep it, lest we...
I mean,
lest I step into his trap.
It is clearly true, but yeah.
No, what I think, though, even though there wasn't a real, I couldn't really get a real meaning out of it, I think the book could have been improved if...
Yes, I agree with that.
Yes, and that's my review. No, it could have been better. I guess I wanted to... The problem with the It's All a Dream, right? The problem with the It's All a Dream ending is that it completely removes any stakes from the story. Everything we've spent time with previously is now meaningless unless there is a deeper meaning to it about things you can learn on how to be, you know, a better person or whatever. That doesn't seem in the book at all either. So it just seems like it's like an actual dream where it's 90 minutes of nonsense or whatever, and then you wake up and you're like, oh, well, what was the point of any of that, you know? And it's just and I think that is, again, getting back to his obsession with futility, right? So in the same way that so many things that the characters in the book do mean nothing, so does our reading of the book, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Have I confused us all? Okay, so look at the Mad Hatter, right? Stuck at 6 o'clock, can't move past that. It's meaningless. Keeps having tea, doesn't do anything. Life never changes. Everything's meaningless, right? Then you get to the, you know, characters like the Lizard or the Knaves, the Queen. They're just sort of stuck in these loops where they keep doing the same things. Nothing ever changes. Nothing ever gets better. It's just meaningless. And so I think that It's All a Dream at the end is him kind of saying, oh, this whole thing was meaningless the whole time. And you actually reading this book is meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. Maybe that's also that I've been locked down for 13 weeks and I'm very depressed and that's how I'm viewing it. But
no, I can,
you know,
feel I can feel some of that futility and it did feel a bit meaningless reading it. I got to tell you.
The fact that they go back, or he goes back for a sequel, I wonder how he sets up, makes people care for the second time. Like, does he somehow give it stakes? Is it one of these things where there is like she's visiting a real reality, but she's getting there via her dreams or something, you know? Freddy, Nightmare on Elm Street style. Is that, I've never seen it, but I think he gets you in your dreams.
Yeah, so maybe, so, you know, we're now thinking, oh, how disappointing that was all a dream, but in part two, it's like, oh, no, that was real.
Yeah, because at the end of, the start of part two, she opens her hand and she's holding part of a mushroom still or something, you know?
Oh, right. And at the start of part two, Freddy Krueger comes in and like rips her to pieces. And we're like, what is happening?
Oh, all I know about Freddy Krueger is that episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah, with Willy. Willy, yeah.
I'll see you in your dreams.
Well, it's very influential. It sort of amazes me that, like, you know, after reading it, that it has become, it's such an ingrained part of popular culture. Like, we all know the Mad Hatter, we all know the Cheshire Cat, all that sort of stuff. Mm. And they've become their own sort of characters. But they don't do that much in the books. I know I obviously sort of skimmed over and just gave a summary, but they don't. There's sort of that one main scene with the Mad Hatter, and then he's on trial, and the Cheshire Cat sort of comes in a couple of times. But it's amazing that, like, you know, we all know those characters so much.
Yeah. I found the TV movies. It was a two-parter that I and Dave, I've talked to you about it in the past where my Nana and Granddad had three videos.
Oh, that's right.
VHS tapes that we could watch. I forgot about this. This is the fourth tape. So there was Goodbye, Mr. Chips or whatever.
What were they, Matt? Goodbye what?
Goodbye, Mr. Chips, I think. Or Mr. Chips Goes to Hollywood.
No, no, it's Goodnight, Mr. Chips. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And The Wizard of Oz were your three.
And Annie. But also this one, they got this one later. So it's a 1985 American two-part made-for-TV.
Am I looking at the right Goodbye, Mr. Chips, a 1939 romantic drama?
Yeah, we never watched that.
Right, okay.
But they had it. Okay. That was the option we never
watched. All three of the movies that Matt had were from 1939, legit.
Yeah, wild. But the
did your grandparents... Did they flee World War II? Is that why? World War II broke out, they had to pack everything up. They only had four tapes. They put them in the trunk and came to Australia. Is that what happened, Matt?
That's right. They had other tapes, but they were all of Burke's backyard, which hasn't aged that
amazingly,
well. Luckily, they didn't live to see his fall.
The stuff from the 30s has aged better than those tapes.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, the politics of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. It turns out Mr. Chips hasn't been cancelled. Good on you, Mr. Chips.
The cast for this is wild. Like, I don't remember much of it, but it's got like Sammy Davis Jr. as the Caterpillar. Sally Struthers, Tiger Lily, Merv Griffin as the conductor, like old school Hollywood stars, yeah. I guess, TV and Hollywood stars from America.
Wow.
Although John Stamos is in it, actually. So there's, you know, Rowdy Roddy McDowell, Ringo Starr, Sid Caesar.
Ringo Starr is in this?
Yeah, Ringo Starr is the Mock Turtle.
From the Beatles?
From the Beatles, yes.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a wild... Like, a lot of these names I'm saying, I don't know them, but I know their name.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
You know who Ringo Starr is, though, obviously.
I know who Ringo Starr is. I know who Sammy Davis Jr. is. Merv Griffin, I think, was like a talk show host.
Mm. I know that from Kramer putting the set inside his house.
Yes.
Remember?
Ernest... Borgnine?
Ernest Borgnine, also a Simpsons guest star from McHale's Navy.
Bo Bridges? Yeah, Bo Bridges, big eyebrows. All right, maybe it's not that much of an all-star cast.
Hey, it started out huge.
It's almost like Matt was reading them in cast order from most famous.
He starts reading out the best boy. We're like, never heard of
him.
Yeah,
he's just reading out the credits. Like, Matt, we don't know.
I love the name.
Matt, we don't need to know this was filmed in Toronto, okay?
The guy who played the White Rabbit's name was Red Buttons. That can't be a real name. Red Buttons. Great name.
That is a great name.
What did you think of the book, Dave? Did you enjoy the book, Dave?
Did I enjoy the book?
Mm.
Well, like, we always get you guys and myself to score it out of five. And
okay,
I will tell.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Maybe I'll get you to score it first, but I will let you in on a little sizzle. I did not love it. I did not enjoy reading this.
Okay. I would... okay. Oh, do you want to throw...
If you weren't there in 1965, I think you probably aren't reading it with the nostalgia that a lot of... Well, we didn't grow up with it. We weren't around at the time.
I think I would rate this... I think I would give this maybe a 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5 from Michael Hing? Okay, yeah. No worries.
I don't like... I found it frustrating. There didn't feel like there was any real growth for Alice, necessarily. I mean, obviously physical growth. I mean, like, emotional growth.
You weren't paying attention. There was,
if anything, too much growth for Alice.
And I think I would have liked her to... I feel like I would have liked her to have to permanently change. Like, if she'd woken up, right, all it would take is for her to wake up from a little dream and be like, oh, it was all a dream. And then for her to, like, have in her pocket, like, a playing card with a crown, like, with a little body attached to it or something like that, you know? And then we're like, oh, was it magical? And that would have made it a 3, you know? Maybe a 3.5.
Wow. That's quite a big bumper. Yeah.
Anyway, what did you think of that?
What if she woke up and she was still 8 meters?
I mean, obviously that's the dream. Then we're in 4.5 territory. If she woke up, had a 9-foot-tall neck and everyone thought she was a giraffe, like, that's... Then we're set up for the sequel. I want to know what happens, you know? Now I'm in.
What if she woke up and she looked across and, like in The Godfather, she saw not a horse's head but her own head? Because she had her head lopped off by the Queen of Cards.
So, in this scenario, Matt, are there 2 heads of Alice?
Yes. So, she's still got her head and then her dream head that's been
right,
cut off.
Right, okay. That's also in 4 territory for me. Yeah.
We should have workshopped this with Louis C. back in the day. But, I think... But it's hard to separate it from the... The icons, can I say iconography? What does that mean?
The symbolism? What do you mean?
Symbolism. Like the, you know, the pop culture references that you just are so familiar with.
Yeah, totally.
It's hard to...
You imagine Alice in the blue dress with the white. Things. You imagine her with blonde hair. Yeah, it's all the...
And I mean, it's like, it's hard to go, this thing that I like is so famous and so well-loved for so long. Mm. Sucks. You know, I mean, maybe it's not that hard to do it. You just did it quite easily. But I'm going to say like 2.5.
2.5 from Matt out of 5. I'm going to give it also a 2 out of 5. And I'm usually very, very generous on this show. I don't think I've ever gone below a 2 before. I mean, I respect the influence on popular culture and all that sort of stuff. But reading it, I did not enjoy it. I found every character, frustrating. They're so farcical that it's just like, oh my God. And then it's just scene after scene of strange stuff. I don't really have the nostalgia for the movies that much. I reckon I probably watched one or two adaptations in my life when I was a kid, but didn't love that. But then I had to remind myself that it's a children's story. So,
yes, that's right.
And people are...
It's not for us.
And people are analysing it, psychoanalyzing, looking for all these hidden messages. At the end of the day, it probably was just a cool story that entertained a kid that he went on a boat ride with once. And then she said, that was really great. And he said, all right, I'm going to write it down. That's probably what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
and then other
fair
kids,
enough.
And the other kids at the time probably went, yeah, that is interesting. That's way more entertaining than the stuff we're currently reading.
Yeah, this is so much better than The Boat We're On.
Yeah.
Well, I don't understand why he couldn't have just had her climb, found the same hole, climb back up it, and then she, you know, even if there was sort of like she climbed back up the hole and then she was in her bed and you go, oh, we don't know if it was a dream or not, but just to be like, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, it's all a dream really soured it for me. I hate it's all a dream. It's all a dream is, my opinion on it's all a dream is on the record in this podcast, but I hate it's all a dream.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to let you down, everyone. I knew that would be an unpopular choice.
Well, you didn't write it. You didn't write it, Dave, so...
And you've had a lot of your great listeners who suggested it. They obviously love it, so...
Yeah,
I think they're wrong. I think all your listeners who love it are wrong.
Sorry, everyone. You heard it here first.
Can you do Goodbye Mr. Chips next time, Dave?
I'll bring it up. I wonder if it's based on a book, if it is.
I'd love to, because I'm never watching it, but I'd love to know what it was about. I won't sit through an hour and a half film, but I'll listen to you for an hour. Tell me what
you
it's about.
Are you telling me that I've got to start doing movie cheat because you can't be bothered watching movies?
As long as it's slightly shorter than the film, then
well,
yes.
Let me just tell you that it is based on the 1934 James Hilton novel, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Oh, we're going to do
oh,
it.
Oh, that's great.
We're doing it.
That'd be fantastic. That's so funny.
And Matt, have you seen this all-star cast in Goodbye, Mr. Chips? We're talking Robert Donahue, Greer Garson, Terry Kilburn, John Mills, Judith Furse. These are all such 1930s names. Austin yeah. Trevor, Edmund Brion.
All of them, they started their careers with like other names and people like, no, we're in Hollywood yeah. now. You're Trevor Gorn or whatever you said.
Milton Rosner.
Incredible names. And I'm looking it up on online. It's only 128 pages, so I love that. I'll
oh, be tearing through. Absolutely fang through that.
Goodbye, Mr. Chips. So, Matt, I'll get you back to it. To finally find out what that tape was all about.
That'd be great. Hing, some of you might not know about Dave, which I only learnt recently. His high school nickname was Mr. Chips.
That's true. It's yeah, actually known as my primary school.
Was this because, Dave, because I don't know if listeners to you, surely listeners must know that you have an obsession with pies.
Yes.
As a child, were you obsessed with chips? Is that where the nickname came from?
100%. I ate, for my recess snack every day, I had chips every single day of primary school. So I got called Mr. Chips.
I feel like that's an unfair nickname. I feel like I'd probably know like half a dozen kids for whom that was true. Chips was a very popular snack in primary school.
Do you think they were referencing the film or the book?
They must have been. Maybe like an adult said it or something and then kids laughed like, oh, that's a funny name, Mr. Chips. Someone must have referenced it, surely.
Or, I mean, Matt, we don't know this because no one's seen the film or read the book, but maybe the book is about a boy who eats chips every day and grows up to be a senator or something. And then he's in Washington and like the president's like, chips are poisonous now or what, I don't know. And then they have to ban them and then he has to come to terms with that. I don't know.
Well, we're going to find out one day, aren't we? But that does bring us to the end of this episode. Hing, Matt, thank you so much for joining me and talking about Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
Thank you for having me.
We want to hear or see more of you. Michael Hing, you've got a TV show coming out very, very soon, which is so exciting because you are the host.
I am the host on the 2nd of October. SBS, the Special Broadcasting Service, the ethnic version of the ABC, has a show coming out called Celebrity Letters and Numbers. It's like a puzzle game show. If you've seen Countdown, if you've seen Letters and Numbers, it's sort of a fun variety program similar to those. Where me and a bunch of comedians and actors and musicians and stuff just play some the Countdown games. So yeah, watch that 8:30 on Saturday nights on SBS in October until the end of the year. And yeah, otherwise I've got two podcasts. One is called Dragon Friends. It's a D&D podcast. You can go listen to that if you need seven seasons of Dungeons and Dragons if you need something to put you to sleep, feel free to. And then also I've got another podcast called Free to a Good Home, which is about classifieds. It's me and my friend Ben Jenkins going through classifieds with guest comedians every week. And it's a whole lot of fun.
Awesome stuff. I'll put a link in the show notes to all that stuff. You want to check out more
That's very kind of you. Thank you, Dave.
Stuff. Thank you so much. And Matt, you've got a podcast galore.
Yeah, I do one with you called Do Go On. The most recent one I wasn't really on, but Michael Hing was, and I'm looking forward to listening to it. It's about can we say the topic? Does that matter, Dave?
It doesn't matter to me. Or maybe it matters to Dave.
Sure, this will come out just before that, but hey.
Oh, sizzle.
This is a sizzle. You're hearing it here. First time you've come to the end of the episode. Let me just say that Michael Hing waxed lyrical about one of his loves, which he's also conflicted about, the history of the FIFA World Cup.
The FIFA Men's World Cup, yes.
Fantastic. And it was a great report, honestly. It's like he'd done it a million times.
You're very kind. So, Matt, you have that. What other podcasts have you got? You got the monkey one?
Yeah, Primates, which at the moment we're doing a deep dive investigation into ape titty slides, which is a thing I didn't know anything about until recently. But we're uncovering quite a story here.
Are you deep down the rabbit hole?
We are deep down. This one goes all the way to the top. We have cracked this.
On Primates, Matt, have you? How far back would I have to go to find the Dunstan checks in episode? Have you done one?
Yeah, I think it was like it was with Nick Mason. It was like episode 5.
Yeah, right. Okay.
It's one of
okay.
the first ones.
I'm obsessed with that film, and I haven't seen it in a long time. And I think it's such a funny idea for a film, and I really want to watch it.
It was so long ago that we did that episode that I've again kind of forgot. I saw it at the cinema.
Yeah, right.
Initially, and I remember it being a pretty good time. Jason Alexander, class act. Can do it all. He's a renaissance man, that guy. But obviously Dunstan was the star of the show. But yeah, we haven't done a movie for a while, but we should do anyway, blah blah blah. Check out that Primates. But yeah, this ape titty slide stuff, very fascinating. If you like sort of true crime podcast with higher stakes, then this is maybe these last three or four episodes are for you. And I'm doing a fringe show, I think, online now, because we're not allowed to do them in the venue, but I'm doing a show with Alistair Tremblay-Birchall, which is going to be like, I mean, really, it's going to be online. It's going to be sort of like a pretty casual.
Oh, yeah? What do you get? Is it sketches? Pretty, is it stand-up? Is it a variety show?
It's going to be, well, it was going to be, the idea of it was for us to be working on new stand-up material. So it's going to just be more conversationally done. I think we're just figuring out a framework for it at the moment. I think it's going to be like, we're thinking about doing it. So it's going to be, Al found this questionnaire, 36 questions to fall in love to or something like that.
Come on, I've done that.
Yeah, right. So, and did it work?
Well, we were doing it as a radio bit, and so it decidedly did not work, but it was for comedic effect.
Okay. Well, it sounds like that bit's been done, so we might have to think of another framework. We don't want to be derivative of Hobber and Hing.
No, this was pre-Hobber and Hing, so please, you're more than welcome to it. But
I think of the Hobber and Hing are kind of like the Simpsons. You know, the Simpsons has done that. Hobber and Hing has done
goodness,
that.
No.
Trying to think of an original.
If you're after a way you could premise your show, though, have you thought about having, say, 40 to 45 just blue jars of liquid that just say "drink yeah, me" good. Or "mats" or something on it, and then just and then working your way through them.
Yes, each one inspires a new anecdote something. Yeah, I like that. That's not a bad idea.
But people do visuals, and see, stand-up comedy traditionally an audio, mostly audio medium. People add visuals now. No one's adding taste, you know. No one's adding taste to stand-up comedy. You could be the first, and especially maybe you could make
more senses,
40 odd cocktails or something, and then people at home on Zoom have to make the cocktails as well. I don't know. There's something. No one's doing taste, Matt, and you could be the person who does it.
Okay, no, that's a good point. We may, and taste, obviously cocktails, I'll include a smell as well. So you're hitting two fresh senses.
But if you know how people pair food with drinks, what if you pair your comedy with a drink?
Oh, like, that's such a great idea. Yeah. Wine pairings for jokes.
Bit, yeah, for this next bit, I reckon you want to get a scotch and soda ready.
That's fun.
Anyway, give Dave and I writing credits on this, please.
We need this.
Please, Matt, please. Talk to Alistair for us, please.
Okay, I'll have a chat.
All right, I'll link to Matt and Al's friend show as well. So, but gentlemen, Matt, Michael, thank you so much for joining me. And
thank
until
you
next
me.
Time, as I always say here, and Michael Hing, you've never heard this before, and it is embarrassing to yell it in my house, but here I go. Books forever!
Books forever!
Books forever, everybody. Books forever.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.